It was supposed to be a truly historic moment.
On March 29th, NASA will conduct the first all-female spacewalk in history.
Astronauts Christina Koch and Anne McLean will head out on a mission to replace batteries with a ground support team also made up entirely of women.
And it still might be, just not for the reason we first thought.
Cook was supposed to participate in the first ever all-women spacewalk. Instead, she will walk alongside a man. NASA says it needs to make some sizing adjustments to the spacesuits for the women on the ISS, and only one will be ready.
For the past few months, there has been a trickling of news, research, and commentary detailing how the world is built for men and examining the results of that approach. But nothing crystallized it for the world at large quite like the first ever all-woman spacewalk being canceled, because there wasn't a second suit to fit a second woman. As Hillary Clinton put it on Twitter, make another suit. But of course, it's not just spacesuits that are the issue here. So maybe it's worth talking to women who operate, sometimes literally, at the highest levels of science and medicine. Maybe it's a good time to ask them what their jobs are like when you have no margin for error, but you're using tools that weren't built for you. So we did. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Shauna Pandya is a physician and a citizen scientist astronaut candidate. She's talking to us from Saskatchewan, where she's got birds in the background. Hi, Shauna.
Hi, Jordan. Thank you so much for having me and my birds today.
How does this happen in 2019?
So there's two schools of thought. When we look at the year and we think to ourselves, hey, we're a modern society, we're aiming to be inclusive, we're aiming to encompass all viewpoints, it seems at first glance egregious that we still haven't had our first all-female spacewalk. In order to understand why we are the way we are, we need to understand the history that's come before. And so when we look at the history of spaceflight, we have to understand the heritage of the astronauts who came before. And so when we look at the composition of Mercury, Apollo, Gemini crews, they were all male. And when we look at the spacesuits that are in use today, they're still the same spacesuits that were used from that early era. So the spacesuits themselves are modular, but they're still modular in the context of having been designed for men. So when we look at spacesuits that are of an appropriate fit, they can, because they're modular, because parts can be swapped out and mixed and matched from different joints, from different limb components to the torso component, they can be made to fit for an increasingly diverse crew that includes females. But ultimately, the heritage of spaceflight and human spaceflight is that it started from a previously homogeneous crew type.
So what would it take to just make another suit now?
A lot of capital. So when we look at the cost of making a spacesuit, I've seen various figures thrown around from $12 million to $22 million looking at the early history of spacesuits. And I've seen even more recent estimates for the development of a spacewalk capable EVA, extravehicular activity suit, ranging in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And so it would require an astronomical cost, forgive the pun, but we would also need to take into account the crew for whom we're designing our new spacesuits. And we would need to take in the heterogeneous nature of a crew into account, as well, realizing who we're designing for.
How have you realized that in some of the work you've done? Because I know you've done some sort of space simulations.
What I've come to realize is that design and design bias is universal. And the first thing is recognizing that. So, for example, I did an analog simulation at the Mars Desert Research Station about this time last year. And what that means is real life on fake Mars. And so essentially you're living in a tin can in a simulated Martian habitat with five other people for 2 weeks on end. And so if you want to go outside, you're essentially going outside on Mars, which will kill you. So you need to go out in a spacesuit. And that was one of the first times I really had this, oh, this really isn't designed for me moment. And yeah. So we have these flight suits. We had backpacks with our simulated life support systems fitting over that. And then we have the helmets. And essentially, I remember saying to one of my teammates, I wish I had the shoulders of a man, because the straps of the spacesuit, the straps of the life support system on the backpack kept slipping off. And when you imagine that our EVA goals include exploring and trekking on foot for 7 to 11 kilometers a day and 27 degrees Celsius heat in the middle of the Utah desert, you want to make everything as conducive to the success of the mission as possible.
What would have happened in space had you encountered the same problem, had this not come up during your simulation?
It would have been an added dimension, a challenge would have been added to the mission, because not only do you have to consider the mission objectives and the fit of your spacesuit, but you also have to consider how a reduced gravity environment compounds any pre-existing issues of fit. So when we look at the Martian environment, for example, it is one-third gravity compared to Earth. If you're already struggling with falling and loose straps in 1G, it's possible that they could become even more buoyant and more of a distraction in one-third gravity.
We've seen kind of a number of stories over the last few months, specifically about, you know, research that was geared towards men or a world that's been designed for men in general. Why do you think the spacesuit and the canceled spacewalk struck such a nerve?
I would equate it to Christmas morning when your expectations are so high and your emotions are running high and you're just so excited for something positive to happen. And then you swing immediately to the other end of the spectrum of emotions of disappointment when it doesn't happen. So I think the emotional letdown was a huge part of it. But I think that's a sign that people are interested in space. They're interested in space being inclusive. And this moment was actually a good learning opportunity for all of us, because it's an opportunity to have a discussion about not just saying the first step of space and space missions being inclusive, but the materials we use, the equipment we use, the spacesuits we use, they have to reflect the composition of the crew. So when we consider the history and the legacy of human spaceflight, and we look at the 560 plus people that have been to space so far, because of the heritage of where those space travelers come from, when we look at the Apollo astronauts, the Mercury astronauts, the Gemini astronauts, they were all men. And so design was fitted to reflect that composition. And so now it's time that we reflect the fact that, yes, we're becoming more inclusive when it comes to space flight. We need to change our mission equipment to reflect that, to set ourselves up for safety and for success.
I mean, space kind of grabs headlines. And I'm glad that we're talking about this today, because it grabbed so many headlines. But as someone who's come up through medicine and through that kind of academic medicinal background, have you noticed this in other areas, like in more everyday examples? Because it's the everyday examples that I've heard over the last week or so that have kind of stunned me.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, there's newspaper articles about it. There's a book about it out now called Invisible Women, Exposing Data Bias in a World Designed for Men, by Caroline Craig Perez. And basically, it looks at the scope of design bias and how it affects us. And so in my own personal experiences in medicine, when I've been in the OR or when I've been in the endoscopy suite, my hands have just been too small to grip the instruments the way they were needed to properly use the instruments. So I've had to adapt my grip, adapt the angle, adapt the way I hold these instruments. And it's not just medicine, it's seatbelts and cars, it's body armor for frontline first responders and for military. And in those cases, as you can imagine, it's not just a comfort issue, it's a safety issue.
It seems kind of insane that we're only just seeing this in all these fields now when, you know, we're talking about medicine and policing and fields that have existed for decades and that these tools have been around for a long time. It's not like we're making new spacesuits, you know?
Absolutely. But I would say that outrage isn't productive. Asking what happens next is being grateful that this is coming to the forefront and using it as an opportunity to say, we can make design better. We can make it more inclusive, and in so doing, set our teams up for success.
With regards to the kind of everyday things in medicine and elsewhere, have you talked to other women in your field about it? Is this kind of something that everybody realizes but hasn't been part of the general conversation until recently?
Yeah, it's something that we have accepted as par for the course. And I think the conversation now is turning to, hey, we don't need to accept this as canon. So, for example, when I started off learning endoscopy, I was told, you're a woman, and my mentor was a woman, you're just going to have to learn to adapt, as we all have. So it's something that we've all acknowledged. When I posted online about this, another laparoscopic surgeon, you know, chimed in and said, yeah, it destroyed my hands by having to adapt to these instruments. So it's definitely something that we all talk about amongst ourselves, but perhaps it's time to have a larger conversation around design in all disciplines.
What does happen next? Because obviously, when you're talking about tools that are so widely distributed in fields that are practiced by, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, what kinds of things need to change beyond kind of just conversations like this?
We need to create a pathway for implementation for design that is safe and that is functional for all team members. And so I'll give you an example. In one of my citizen science testing and training courses, it was called emergency spacecraft egress and sea survival. And that's a fancy way of saying if your space capsule crash lands in the ocean and you're in your spacesuit, can you escape your downed craft and make it to safety? And so what we found is that there were certain design elements of the spacesuit that really made things harder for smaller body types. And one of that was what we call the LPU, which is the life preserver unit. And they were quite large. And especially if you were a smaller human being, especially for the females, they definitely threw our balance off in the water. But it was a conversation we were able to have, and it was input we were able to give, because in my experiences in the citizen science astronautics world, crew composition more often than not has been 50-50 in terms of gender split. So the first step is inclusion. If you want to be more inclusive, and why wouldn't you? Because you're inviting more perspectives to the table and setting yourself up for success. If you want to be more inclusive, involve them at all aspects of the process, all aspects of the mission process, all aspects of the design process, all aspects of planning. Having that inclusion is the first step. But having it all aspects is the second step, because at that point, we're able to give our input that's conducive to my body type. And that is actually taken into account for future iterations of spacesuit design. Diversity inclusion can be a priority, but it needs to have a purpose and it needs to be implemented at all phases of design.
I love that as soon as we started talking about going from words to action, your birds got extremely excited.
Yeah, they are also passionate about diversity and inclusion.
Shauna, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jordan.
Shauna Pandya, a physician and also a citizen scientist astronaut candidate. That was The Big Story. For more from us, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca and also at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And of course on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN and at FrequencyPods on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, and wherever you get your podcasts. Go find us there on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify. We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.